Start at the beginning. Usually is a good idea. Okay. I guess I have the role of introducing myself. If you don't know me, I'm Keith Miller, currently a faculty at Kansas State University with research interests in paleoecology and paleoclimatology, and increasingly in the public understanding of science. And what I want to talk about ties in with some of the comments that have been made by previous speakers, and that is how has the science of paleontology kind of been filtered through the media? And by media, I don't just mean the secular media or the news media, but the scientific media itself. How is science being communicated in media to the public, and what misunderstandings are commonly communicated along with that scientific information? Just to start out with our beginning point, which is the concept of common descent, the kind of the central model of biological evolution, central unifying model. And this is simply that all living things are connected by an unbroken pattern of ancestor common, and that the result of that is, if you think of all of living things being connected genealogically, as you go back in time, those different lineages merge, and you end up with something that looks like a tree or a bush. And that's one of the fundamental models that was put forward by Darwin. One of his primary contributions was picturing evolution as this tree or bush. And it's an extremely powerful model. And it's a very easily grasped model. It's visual. It's simple. But it also shows that it's a predictive model. In other words, if a tree or a bush is an accurate portrayal of the actual history of life, it has certain consequences, certain predictive consequences. It has certain things that we should, as a result, expect from the fossil record or expect from genomic research. And one of the things I'm really going to be emphasizing here is it has to do with patterns. Okay? This has to do with pattern recognition. It's going to be one of my really important points here. So what's the media problem that I want to focus on? The problem is that popular media, again, not just the boogeyman of the newspaper reporter that comes and interviews you and puts one sentence in and gets it wrong, but actually stuff that comes out of the scientific community itself, out of the academic community itself, is on particular discoveries at the expense of historical patterns. Okay? Paleontology, as an example, which is commonly portrayed as a series of kind of serendipitous discoveries, rather than a systematic discovery that is based on some kind of predictive theory. In other words, the emphasis is on, Joe Smo just went to Greenland and he just found this spectacular fossil, and isn't this so cool? And this just solves all these outstanding problems of paleontology. And it all hinges on this wonderful new discovery. It's very particular. Nothing about the patterns of scientific discovery, of patterns of data. It's this particular fossil found by this particular guy. And isn't this really spectacular? You don't have to go very far to see this. I mean, just do some searches, and that's almost all that hits you in the face. Okay, all these are just headlines. Okay, Ambulocetus, early whale, a missing link between terrestrial mammals and whales. Okay. Four-winged fossil bridges bird's dinosaur gap. That's in Science News. Tiktaalik, the missing link, right? first sentence in that article, this is from The Guardian, UK publication, a crocodile-like fossil called Tiktaalik rosiae found in Ellesmere Island, Canada, sent scientists wild with excitement, a missing link between fish and land animals. It shows how creatures first walked out of the water and onto dry land more than 375 million years ago. In other words, it's all particular. Okay? So, nope. What about, I mean, is that the only fossil we know of? I mean, no discussion of context. No context there whatsoever. No discussion of pattern. Just really new spectacular fossil which is going to overturn significantly advance our understanding. Notice that almost all those have the word missing link in them. Okay? And that's an awful phrase. Terrible, awful phrase. Because what it implies is that the validity of an evolutionary interpretation hinges on this specimen. I mean, before we had this great evolutionary model, this great evolutionary vision, but there's this big gap there. If we could only find that missing link, then we'd have some evidence, right? So here is that final missing link that's been missing all this time, and now we can believe it, right? Because we have this missing link. What happens if you take the link away? You don't have any evidence, right? If someone says, well, there's something wrong with that specimen, or you really got it wrong, or you really interpreted the anatomy of that fossil incorrectly, well, then there must not be any evidence for evolution, right? The missing link is gone, we're missing again. It also emphasizes particulars. There's no sense of pattern there. What's the pattern that this link fits into? And it also reinforces the idea of the ladder of evolution, right? Missing link is like, you know, rungs on a ladder, okay? And this goes back to much earlier pictures of evolutionary theory, which were linear. It's called orthogenesis. It's really kind of Lamarckian, or even earlier kind of views, you know, the chain, great chain of being and so forth, in which organisms are kind of climbing up this ladder from primitive to advanced, right? And what it implies is that one thing succeeds another in time. And everything's crawling up this ladder. And that you can't have that, quote, ancestor be coextensive with its descendants, right? You have one rung, past that rung, you have another rung on top of it. So you can't have the old rung up here. You can't, you know, you can't have your rung down here suddenly appear up here again, right? And it also implies, well, if you're missing a rung, right, you're going to fall through. The ladder gets cut in half. That's the end of the ladder. Pull a rung out, and the ladder falls in two, right? So this also brings up the problem of ancestors, which I'll also talk about. So here is a really good illustration of how this goes awry really quickly. This is a story of Archaeoraptor, which some of you may know of. This was the on the right there is the front page of National Geographic, where this appeared. And there's the headline, it's a missing link, right? Between terrestrial dinosaurs and birds that could actually fly. This is a fossil came out of China. China is extraordinarily rich in fossils, particularly extraordinarily well-preserved fossils from a couple particular intervals of time. And this is a really spectacular fossil. But what turned out, when it was brought to the United States through the black market, it wasn't obtained legally. And what happens is the market of these fossils in China is huge. And it's a huge economic incentive for the Chinese to sell these things. And the nicer the fossil, the more spectacular the fossil, the more money they get for it. I mean, if someone finds one of these fossils and sells it, I mean, they can make a lifetime's worth of income. And so there's a lot of black market in fossils coming out of China. Well, it turns out that this particular fossil was put together from multiple specimens, In other words, they didn't have a complete specimen. Scientists like more complete specimens. It provides more information. So what they did is they took several specimens and they pieced them together very well, very cleverly, to look like a single specimen. Problem is, the pieces they put together weren't from the same species. Okay? Put together from two different types of dinosaurs. Well, National Geographic really blew this really bad, because even before the thing was published, there was already a lot of questions and uncertainty and questions about the specimen, but they went ahead and published anyway. Shortly after the thing was published, it became clear that this was a forged specimen, so that Archaeoraptor doesn't exist. It is not. There's no legitimate thing called an Archaeoraptor. Okay, it's put together from two different species. And here is the coverage. This is, you know, National Geographic News, BBC Online. This is reflecting the scientific community's response to this revelation of this is a fraudulent specimen. Archaeoraptor fossil was introduced in 1999 and hailed as the missing evolutionary link between carnivorous dinosaurs and modern birds. Forensic analysis of a forged fossil, once hailed as a missing link between birds and dinosaurs, has shed light on its murky origins. So what's going to happen to those people in the public who already doubt the veracity of evolution? Well, right? Have this ladder. This is a missing link. We finally found it. We can now show that birds are descended from dinosaurs. Oh, that specimen is a fraud. Well, what do you... of course it's a fraud. That's what all scientists do. It's all... evolution is built up by all these fraudulent specimens. That's because everything is hinged on this one specimen, as though Archaeoraptor is the solution to understanding the evolutionary origin of birds, right? So you take that specimen away, well, the whole thing collapses. And that appears, this is in some of the creationist literature, jumped all over it. Here is another specimen some of you may have heard about. This is Ida. It was fondly named Ida. It's a primitive fossil primate. Another really spectacularly preserved specimen. And this isn't a fraudulent specimen. This is a superb, excellent specimen. But look how it was reported. Fossil Ida, extraordinary find, is human evolution, right? This is a primitive primate. The question is whether it's more closely related to lemurs or to primates that are more closely related to monkeys, right? So they're presenting it as the missing link to human, right? Missing link in human evolution. Second one, missing link fossil was not human ancestor, as anthropologists say. Well, that's because in a reanalysis of the specimen, using what's called cladistic analysis and looking more closely at the character states of this particular specimen, said, well, maybe the original authors got it wrong. It's really not on this side of the branch. It's on this side of the branch. So instead of the branch coming off here, it comes off over here, and it's really more closely related to lemurs than it is to the other primates. So it really isn't in our lineage. Okay? Well, as you can guess, people jumped all over that one as well. Okay? You take a fossil, it's a legitimate, it's a very valuable specimen, it's an important specimen, it adds additional detail to our previous understanding, and its whole significance is completely distorted by the way that it's been presented in the media. And here's this question of ancestors. It's another awful word along with missing link. And in paleontology, no particular species or specimen can ever be identified as an actual ancestor. We don't look for ancestors in paleontology. Why? Because there's no way that we could recognize one even if we had one. And two, the chances of actually finding an ancestor are minuscule. The way to think about this is think of your own genealogy, right? So you have, your parents and your great-grandparents and your great-great-grandparents and your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. And then you have all your uncles, you know, your great-uncles and your first cousins once removed and twice removed and three times removed. You have this whole tree network of your ancestry. And let's, go back 100 generations, right? And then we take and wipe out 90% of the record of your family tree. What's the chances that we actually have your great-great-great-great-grandfather? Pretty small. We might have your great-great-great-uncle or your first cousin five times removed, right? But the chances of actually having your great-great-great-great-grandfather is pretty small, just because we only have a sampling, right? So that's why paleontologists don't worry about ancestors. Because even if I had the actual specimen in my hand that was actually a lineal ancestor, there would be absolutely no conceivable way that you could prove or demonstrate it. You could say it's closely related, it's somewhere in our tree or lineage, but you couldn't say it's an actual ancestor. So we don't worry about ancestors. We worry about patterns. We worry about historical patterns, reconstructing patterns. But the media wants ancestors, okay? And reflects everything in terms of ancestors. This is another recent specimen, a number of several years ago, really significant business specimen. Out of press. And here's how it was shown in the media. Key human ancestor found. Fossil links, apes, and first humans. Okay? Again, this is in National Geographic. Well, this is a response to that from the anti-evolutionary community, saying Lee Berg and his team do recognize that they're also fossils to be the actual ancestor of genus Homo. Stories of fossils assigned to Homo, but they suggest that earlier yet undiscovered members of a set of could not ancestors of Homo. How would one go about verifying the fossils not yet discovered are the ancestors of genus Homo? Now, what's happened is the discoverers and the describers of the specimens get caught in their own rhetoric. Impressed, well, is this really an ancestor? Well, no, it really isn't. And we can't say it's an ancestor. But it's a member of the lineage that included the ancestor that we haven't found yet, right? And that would be a legitimate response. The chances are that we'll never find that ancestor. Really isn't the ancestor after all. Well, obviously, this link in the chain of human ancestry doesn't exist. Human evolution is... again, this is the same thing. Again, responding to that same specimen and the media response to it. But what's missing is that we have this whole pattern. We have this whole diversity of specimens available to us. You go to the American Museum exhibit. Their new human evolution exhibit. And there's like a whole wall that stretches like 25 feet covered with skulls. Covered with hominid and hominid skulls. There's a lot of specimens. Okay? And they actually demonstrate a very... understand a lot about the pattern of human ancestry. And here is this is from Matsky from the NCSE a while back. What he did is he just put all the data for the estimated cranial capacities of all the known hominid specimens up to that time. So this is up to 2006. And just plotted on a graph. There's cranial capacity and time. And wow, that's pretty cool. Right? There is a pattern there. That's the pattern of the hominid fossil record. Now, what if I took away one of those blue dots? Does that make the pattern go away? But that's the way the media portrays things, as though this one dot is somehow crucial to the pattern. Well, it's a part of the pattern. It makes the pattern more complete, gives us more detailed understanding of what the nature of the pattern is. But the pattern is a pattern. The pattern isn't a point. Okay, a pattern is what the whole spectrum of the available data shows. But that gets lost. The last thing I want to say is classification, which also complicates this. And that is that there's an emphasis on wanting to put names to things. That's part of being human, right? We name everything. We feel like if we name something, we know it. We have it in our grasp if we put a name on it. And so a lot, and some of this is very legitimate. Classification is important. Taxonomy is an important aspect of paleontology. And paleontologists fight over taxonomy all the time, fight over the proper classification of particular specimens all the time. But it doesn't change if you change how you name something. You know, there's a debate over whether this particular specimen belongs in this genus or that genus, or in this family or that family, okay? And there's all this contentious debate over what its proper name is, what its proper classification is. Well, if it suddenly switches from, well, like in the case of Ida, from being on the branch of the tree going to the modern primates versus to the branch of lemurs, and it jumps from, you know, kind of one branch to the other, does that change the specimen? The specimen is still the specimen. I mean, the fossil is still a fossil. It doesn't suddenly morph into something else. Or if his debate is this an avian dinosaur or is this a non-avian dinosaur? You know, is this in the lineage of birds or not? It doesn't. If someone says, well, no, I guess it really isn't a bird. It's just a dinosaur. It doesn't suddenly lose all of its feathers and everything. The fossil doesn't change. We've just changed its name. And Archaeopteryx is one of those, many of the other. The reason I bring up Archaeopteryx is I found this quote rather interesting. It's an old quote back from Gish, way back in his Fossils Say No in 1979. And he says, the so-called intermediate is no real intermediate at all because, as paleontologists acknowledge, Archaeopteryx was a true bird. It had wings. It was completely feathered. It flew. It was not a halfway bird. It was a bird. So it can't be an intermediate, right? Because I'm going to call it a bird. Therefore, I've resolved the problem. Its intermediate characters all evaporate because it's a bird, right? That solves the problem. Well, since that, there's been a whole host of feathers. These are all dinosaurs. Non-avian dinosaurs at that. These are all feathered dinosaurs. There's a whole panoply of these things now from all different branches. There's troodontids. There's dromaeosaurids. There's oviraptors. There's scantiopterids. These are all different branches of dinosaurs, all that possess feathers. And some of them were flighted. Some of them were actually flying dinosaurs. But they weren't birds. Actually, some recent analysis by some people even suggests that Archaeopteryx may not have been a bird. Here's whales. There's a whole series now, something like 20-some odd genera of walking whales that connect a fully terrestrial whale, as a Pachycetus in the lower right, to fully aquatic whales through things like Ambulocetus, Rhodocetus, a whole host, like there's 20-some genera of these things now. But because of the focus on what is it, you know, well, is it a whale or not a whale, right? Again, this is from the ICR, Institute for Creation Research, 2008. And this is referring to Ambulocetus, the specimen that I just, the big, larger specimen there. When some of the ICR staff looked at the picture with the knowledge that Thavison and fellow workers called this creature a whale, they laughed. Evolutionists may claim that this was because of ignorance of subtle distinctions of anatomy. On the other hand, associating the word whale with a creature with large and powerful front and hind legs does seem a bit ludicrous to skeptics. Well, this can't be a whale. It had legs. So it's not a whale. So how can you possibly call it an intermediate? It has legs. It can't be a whale. So there aren't any intermediates. See how the being able to put it in a group in your mind suddenly eliminates the intermediates. Because I could put it in a group. It's either it's a bird or it's not a bird. It's a whale or it's not a whale. Therefore, there aren't any intermediates. Because it's in a group, right? It's a whale. It's a bird. Whereas there's a whole host of these things. This has been mentioned briefly. The media always wants controversy. And so things are presented in a controversial fashion, even when they're not. There's questions, particularly over the origins of groups or lineages. Excessive focus on that as opposed to, again, the overall patterns. Last case study I'm going to mention is this one, which is fairly recent, rather interesting. Some workers published a paper that looked at the lungs, the way the respiratory system of birds work, and the respiratory systems of dinosaurs, bird-like dinosaurs. And determine that the bird lung was very unique and distinct and unlike those of the bird-like dinosaurs. That was kind of the sum of their scientific publication. But those authors wrote a press release. And in that press release, they further argued something that wasn't in the paper at all. It wasn't supported by anything that was in the paper. They never made this claim in the paper that was published, that therefore birds couldn't have descended from dinosaurs. What happened was, see, now this makes it controversial, right? Because descent of birds from dinosaurs is kind of the reigning paradigm now in paleontology for the origin of birds. So this generates a controversy. So this is presented as now opposition, evidence against the evolution of birds from dinosaurs, when the paper itself is nothing of the sort. The comments about the questioning the evolution of birds from dinosaurs was nowhere in the published peer-reviewed published paper. It was in the press release by the authors that was picked up by the media and published without ever reading the paper at all. Obviously, the news media that published this news report, never went back and actually read the paper and found that the paper and the press release weren't saying the same thing. And Answers in Genesis picks this up and say, look, here's the scientific community itself saying that evolution of birds didn't occur. Because here's this paper that was published in this reputable journal that was proof positive that birds couldn't have descended from dinosaurs. This is really interesting. This is publicity. This is controversy trumping science. The whole controversial package was what was sold, and the article, you know, got lost. The actual article, peer-reviewed article, isn't even in view anymore. So, to conclude, terms such as missing link or ancestor should be avoided, again, because they reinforce misconceptions. When interacting with the media, the public, and the public, scientists need to emphasize the context of discoveries. In other words, it's what we deal with as scientists is patterns. That's what science is pattern recognition. And it's really important that we make that clear, okay? That we help the public see that there's an enormous mass of observations and data that makes very persuasive patterns. And those patterns are what drive the science. And as Christians, I think we should be as careful in how we do that to the public, how we communicate our work and our discoveries to science, as we are with our Christian faith. Because if not, they're likely to be misrepresented. Thank you.